Hey, everybody. I've got a little bit of housekeeping here before we get into the episode about Instagram and Theology Beer Camp. So I've been getting more active on Instagram, and I just want to let you guys know, in case you want to see me make some videos where I look directly into the camera, I'm sharing some stories and posts about basically all the topics that we cover on this show over at Instagram.com/DanKoke. That's C-O-K-E, and the link is in the show notes. Also, Theology Beer Camp is returning in 2024, October 17th through 19th. The theme is Return of the God Pods. That is a Lord of the Rings reference, which should surprise nobody. I will be there alongside Brian McLaren, Diana Butler-Bass, The New Evangelicals, Bible for Normal People, Tony and Josh from GGCH, of course, Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity, and a whole grip of others. And you can use the promo code RETURNOFYHP, all one word, for $25 off your ticket. Prices go up starting June 1st. That link will be in the notes. I hope to see a bunch of you guys there in October. It was a serious highlight of last year for me. My name is Dan Koch. Like many of you, I've been on a complicated faith journey for a number of years now. And while I tend to find myself on the progressive side of Christianity, my goal is not to make liberal converts. I want this show to be a resource for Christians to my right and to my left, as well as former Christians and non-religious folks, anyone who finds themselves asking difficult questions about God, science, prayer, fate, suffering, evangelism, and more. So many of us have been given bad answers to those good questions, often by people with pure intentions. I want to say that you have permission to take both Christianity and the modern world very seriously. And I hope to facilitate that by introducing you to people seeking God across the Christian spectrum, engaging hard questions in a multitude of ways. Thanks for listening. What a treat today. My dear real life friend, Brian Hall, I would say former production music mentor, even, really kind of helped me get my career going in that world 12, 13 years ago. Glad to have you here on You Have Permission, Brian.
Glad to be here, Dan. This is wild.
Now I'm 2 for 2 on these Still Christian episodes in talking to fellow musicians. There's something about that. I mentioned it last time with John and Tyson, that I am, there's something about my curiosity around people who create things and their faith. It's different than other lines of work, sort of other activities people can be involved in. Mm. And I'm still kind of teasing apart like what that connection is about. And we will be talking about a song that you wrote and recorded with your band Tenths called Huta that is, I mean, really, it might just be one of my 100 or so favorite songs of all time. And it relates to your own story of faith and reclaiming and changing and all that stuff. So I'll play that song or part of that song kind of when that comes up in conversation. That was sort of the impetus, was our chatting about that song, because I started gushing to you over text one day, and maybe in a couple in-person hangs. You're down in Portland, I'm up in Seattle, so we get to see each other once or twice a year. On a good year. But Brian, let's just start here. So if the point is that you are still Christian, like what kind of Christianity were you given as a kid? Like where did the meaning of the word Christianity start for you?
Yeah. I mean, there were kind of a lot of threads to my story. On my mom's side, long line of Baptist ministers, kind of like old guard Baptist. You know, my grandpa used to say, we act liberal, even though we're conservative, you know, like they worked really hard to serve their communities and believed that good things came out of that naturally. And their communities were built on really pretty earnest and genuine connection at some point. It feels like to me the way they talked about it, you know? And
yeah.
So I kind of was like Foursquare Baptist, and we church hopped a lot. And as I got older, it got more charismatic, a little more authoritative, also much more mystical. My dad's a very unique and odd person and wonderful person. And he is intensely like mystical and commonly invited me into the practice of experiencing God as a young person. And I think spent a lot of time in his emotions, exploring, trying to understand his own inner world and figure out how to grow, kind of almost like a mechanic, like sort of trying to understand and infiltrate his emotions and reorient them toward God. And so I had a lot of different, almost differing voices that ultimately caused a lot of tension and I think stressed me out as a young person. I would say the thing that I feel like I inherited that was significant to me was the contemplative practice of being a Christian, experiencing God in community. And there were a whole lot of other things attached to that.
Ultimately, is it that kind of direct practice that is going to be the thing later in the story that kind of either brings you back or keeps you tethered?
Definitely. No spoilers.
Yeah. Okay. Well, before we get to that part, you mentioned a few terms here, and I want to kind of explicate them a little bit with you. And then I want to talk about what an odd mix this is, I think, in American Protestantism anyway. So you said it got more charismatic as you got older, by which I assume you mean speaking in tongues. I don't know, was there slang in the spirit? Was there dancing in the pews? A more kind of effervescent sort of waiting on God, prophecy, that kind of thing?
It wasn't like on the high spectrum of charismatic in that.
Okay.
We had relationships with other congregations that were more like that and some that were less like that. We were kind of, so there was praying in tongues. There was a lot of the practice of the prophetic, if you will. We would, as a college group, the thing that was really wild and unique is we would have, I mean, this was like probably junior year of high school all the way through till around when I got married at like 21. We would like walk around in the backyard and pray in tongues and like dance for like 3 hours on a Friday night. Or we would all get together in someone's living room as like 20-year-olds in college, and we would just pray for each other and like laugh and be silly, and interchangeably play Precision Lob or whatever ridiculous game. Like, it was a bunch of college kids, but like it was a lot of alternative kids. Mm. So that was the charismatic part of it.
That's so interesting. And again, so this is going to really kind of butt up against these terms you used. By the way, the four things I'm kind of looking at is the word charismatic, the word authoritative, the word mystical, and then your description of your dad as really trying to work out his inner world, including working with his emotions. Mm-hmm. And those four things just like do not tend to go together, maybe two and two on opposite sides. So the next one is authoritative, and I take you to mean a reference to the stuff that I've talked about on this show, which is authoritative or authoritarian versus nurturant religion episode, where we're talking about, applying parenting models to essentially understanding faith communities and understandings of God, right? So authoritative or authoritarian, depending on which phraseology you're using, this is a God that is a taskmaster God, much like we might imagine an old school 1950s hard ass dad. These are the rules. We will kind of break you of your will. Your job on earth is to get yourself in line with what God requires. I just finished watching Fargo season 5, which I will try not to spoil anything about, but it has me thinking about a lot of these things. The John Hamm character who plays this like libertarian sheriff in North Dakota and is like very steeped in certain biblical passages and not others, like this kind of authoritarian figure and that vision of God. Get in line. Get your shit together. That's interesting. That is often combined with charismatic theology. Like that part I can see, but there is a natural tension there.
So my family was pretty moderate. I would maybe put them at like a 3 on the authoritative scale or a 4. Like there was definitely traces of mid-20th century Americana, like hard ass energy for sure. But it was not the featured thing. I heard a family therapist we were working with said, like, some people parent a kid to teach them how to live right, and other people parent a kid to help them be everything they can be. And my parents were kind of in the middle, but a little bit, I don't know. It's hard to nail. Yeah. But my dad had like a struggle, and to some extent, we experienced his struggle as proxy of him. So, but what happened as in the charismatic church, that was authoritative. Like Amy and I, who have been married for 20 years, this is crazy. This is a crazy story. We fell in love. We were two like hipster kids. We'd commute up to Portland to go to shows, all ages shows together. And that was like how we fell in love, driving to all ages shows in Portland. And we were both part of this church and both devout. She was like more like check more boxes. She was more of a disciplined, good Christian than I was, and very fervent, earnest kid. And I was kind of struggling more. And I was like the worship pastor at our youth group, and the leadership at our church, like basically observed that we were moving too quickly in our relationship in a very authoritative environment and felt that I wasn't mature enough for that. And so they told me like, you need to stop seeing this girl or you can't be part of our community anymore.
Literally on my spiritual abuse inventory.
So here's what's crazy is I said, okay. And I went into deep depression and really braced the notion that I was not handling my shit.
Yeah.
And I went off into the wilderness and had this profound, like life-changing 12 months where I got the most depressed I'd ever been. I was sitting on a beach with my grandpa. I was visiting the Puget Sound where...
You went into the emotional wilderness for 12 months, not the literal wilderness for 12 months?
Emotional.
Yeah. Okay. But then at one point you're on the beach, which is kind of the wilderness.
Thank you. Yeah. I was on the beach, like at my cousin's wedding, and my grandpa was there, and he said, you know, my father, this is like a story time. So my grandpa's father, who is like the ultimate patriarch, pastor, Jesus freak, who would cry when he talked about the gospel. Wow. So my grandpa's dad, he would pace around his office for hours when he got really upset, and he would repeat the Bible verse over and over again. He began a good work and you will be faithful to complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. And I heard that and I had this crazy moment of belief or faith or something where I was like, I am just a fuck up kid that's finding God, and God has got me, and there's a purpose to all this, and I'm going to lean into it. And I just exponentially grew through that. And that was the beginning of this period of my life where I just was like, you know, you have like camp high.
Oh yeah.
You go to youth group camp and then you're like, I love Jesus for like 3 weeks. And then you're looking at porn again after that or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. So that would be specifically the thing that would let you know it was over in that framework.
Yeah.
That's the only sin.
Yeah.
Is the one that is like at that point, psychologically powerful enough to break you down. Like you could come back from camp and 3 weeks later be like really mean to someone, that's not going to end your spiritual high. It's only if you masturbate.
So many things people from different corners of the country can commiserate over. So that was the beginning of this period that was not like a camp high. It was like 3 years of just like constantly experiencing this feeling of I was like floating for like 2 or 3 years. And it really, and I got married during that time to that same girl, the Amy still married to.
Yeah.
And that experience has been a paradox because it's been a counterpoint to my impulse to look back so cynically, which I have done plenty of. But that moment is definitely a paradox in my story. But it really like good old fashioned Christian joy really started to evaporate when our church community imploded and my destruction began at the age of 20. Amy was 20 and a half. I was 21 when we got married. I'm now 40. So
yeah. The next term here is mystical. But by the way, I feel like you need to like write something like a novelization or something of your family line. Like it just seems rich. Maybe later when, you know,
like a memoir in my 60s or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Like when everybody is dead and it's, you know, anyway, mystical. So it got more mystical as time went on. I mean, you've maybe kind of filled that out a bit, but is there anything else to say about what you mean by your faith getting more mystical as you got older?
It's really hard to quantify that term. I think like, and especially without Christianese, I can try to do both. Maybe one of the things I always used to talk about is like, why did Jesus die on the cross? Was it for propitiation or this other subplot, which was a veil being torn? And my dad's interest was always in that closeness to God, the access we had into the inner throne room, which he would talk about a lot.
Yeah.
And what that means and how that should be the focus of the Christian experience. So that was like maybe a high level, if you talk about theology, way of thinking about it. you know, I've done half of the existentialism in Christianity. That's how I...
Oh, the class I did with Tripp. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're talking about like the ground of being. I shouldn't try to explain that briefly because I'll fumble. But basically, like for me, Christianity, especially during, but also in the wake of my Christian experience, it became this thing where there was all this negative energy and it was everywhere. And I didn't know whether the Christianity was saving from me from the Christianity or the Christianity was saving me from something else, but I was just feeling all this negative energy. But also inside of it, I got this like jewel that was like a religious practice where I could kind of dig through the weeds and find the ground of being, whatever this sort of like, I could find God. And I really learned the practice of experiencing God. Like I can go for a walk right now and sort of pray and think about my life and repent of things and be grateful. There's a lot of gratitude in my prayer life. And by the end of it, I'll feel like my whole body is like radiating, like I just had really good sex or got runner's high or got out of a cold plunge. That happens to me when I walk, like every time. And that's a very experiential thing to talk about. But I think what's more significant is I have this framework for getting through really complicated shit. That's like deeply important to me. Like I still practice repentance. I still practice so many of the things that were deposited in me. And they're really, I don't go to church. I am the most complicated person you'll ever hear. And that I'll like bitch about church with you for hours, you know? And I try not to go there anymore, but then but so many of my friends are evangelicals, like, you know, and close friends. And so much of my interest and my passion in life is around this incredible experience I've had, the spiritual practice I learned coming up.
Okay, there's so many things to dive into. I still want to get to that fourth thing about your dad kind of where I just want to lay all this groundwork. So your dad kind of struggling between the authoritativeness of the specific worship community that you guys were in, and then also this deep conviction he had that what Christ's death and resurrection, what is meant to signify to people practically is that we have full direct access to God and that this happens essentially on the inside. I take it to mean that that's why he was so interested in his emotions, in other aspects of his inner world, because it sounds like what your dad saw or believed or whatever tried to share with you is that like, in our innermost kind of silent center as human beings, like in that place, we have everything required to be in touch with the divine. He would have said Jesus and God. Now we could swap that out for the ground of being, right? Yep. But the terminology is not what's important here, as I understand it. It's almost like a mechanics drawing of a, you know, it's like a very, like you were saying earlier, your dad almost like an engineer trying to understand how this thing works. Mm-hmm. And basically it's like it's like a schematic of what you might call the human soul or whatever, but it's just like, it's within you and you can go there. So am I connecting that correctly?
Yeah. He has diagrams on diagrams. He's written thousands of pages and rewritten thousands of pages, and he struggles to actually finish and publish, but he has published a little bit too, self-published. And he calls it heart training. And his idea is that our hearts just do things and we don't have any control over them. And through the practice of sort of applied scripture, somebody who was dealing with depression, he would provide a list of scriptures. And then he would encourage like the active professing of scriptures that specifically relate to depression as he's found them. And so he would talk about emotional needs being met by God. That's was like one of the big things for him. And that our, what he would call idolatry was us trying to meet those emotional needs through worldly means. That's like his language. So the navigating of spiritual formation for him was understanding what causes you to sin and then addressing that cause on an emotional level.
Yeah. Okay. So here's something for me that is like triple underlined, massively important for how I understand my own faith in 2024. I think we have to make a distinction, for instance, with your dad's system between the specifics of the schematic, of the particular map that any one individual or denomination or creed, you know, the Westminster Confession, whatever, pick a map, right? There are many such maps. There's a distinction between the specifics of the map and the overall principle that we were talking about, which is like somewhere inside of you, you've got access. You don't need to go elsewhere for access.
Yeah.
That principle to me is, I mean, I think objectively, I don't think it's even arguable that every major, if not every, almost every, you know, 98% of significant religious and spiritual traditions in human history, from hunter-gatherer indigenous spirituality to the fucking Catholic Church, everything in between agrees on something like that. And the bigger religions all have their kind of monks and nuns. They have their clerical orders of people who basically commit their entire lives to mapping and experiencing, you know, kind of coming up with their own schematic map because they are so drawn by that experience.
Yeah.
I think for me, a lot of the key of maintaining faith, and I wonder if this will be different for you or if we will agree here, is I got to hold the specific schematic very lightly.
Mm.
That's where we get into problems. If you look too closely, or if you claim too much authority, you run into too many questions. People don't agree. Mm. Different maps disagree with each other. Mm. Then people will stomp their authoritative foot down and say, well, this is the way the schematic is accurately drawn. And then that can turn us off to the basic thing, which is like every human being can shut their mouth, calm their mind, and have something happen to them that is, generally speaking, calming, grounding, you know, and with more and more practice, you know, you start to experience that as richer and deeper. I do think that there are meaningful differences in brains, in personality. Mm-hmm. Like I've learned to be careful about not universalizing this too much because not everybody has the same experience when they try this kind of thing. I've had to have some painful conversations with friends where I kind of assumed too much of what they would experience.
Mm.
But generally speaking, across cultures and traditions, this is like the main kind of shared kernel of the religious or spiritual life. And that we can separate that out from the specifics of the map, of each particular map. Is that resonating?
Yeah, big time. I think a lot about like the thing that always punches me in the gut with an evangelical is in the comments on my Instagram or whatever, is like a conservative person is like, they're like, you just got to like, you know, stop all this negativity and like trust Jesus, you know? And for me, my antidote to that is like the thing that I want from my religion of origin, that man, what's his name? The guy you do the existentialism, the other podcaster, the Christian
Trip Fuller.
Yeah. So Trip, you guys were talking and you said it so poignantly, like the use of Christianity or any religion is to provide access to the divine. And to the extent that it does that, it is useful for me. I'm very comfortable now. And really probably the cornerstone of my deconstruction has been to say that to the extent that my religion does not serve me or my family in allowing us to get access to the divine, it should be readily discarded. Like I'm good with that. And so when that person says that, it's like, well, you're attaching so much social context and everything to you when you say I need to follow Jesus, but I aspire, you know, to be like a kid. Like I aspire to be so unburdened by so much of this stuff that I've experienced and so able to experience the divine in like a really, really formative way. That's what I want, you know. That's really all I care about for my kids is that. And I think it's really exactly what you just said. Yeah. So,
well, this is, I think, a good time to kind of bring artistry into it a little bit, though, because I think that something that you have in spades as your friend is an artist's temperament, kind of an artist's orientation to the world. We can cut this out if you don't want this kind of statement in here, but like, let me motivate that a little bit. Yeah. I have been working with the company that you co-founded for 12 plus years now, and like 4 years into that, you sold your half and were like, well, this will just give me more freedom to like create the things I'd like to create. And it was like a extremely growing business. And like, I was very surprised that you did that. Now I think I would say it makes sense to me because I've gotten to know you better. And you just were like, you probably got in that business to be creative. And then once it was too much administration or whatever else, your partner who enjoys that stuff, likes running a business, is very good at it. Your former partner, Ryan Wines, president of Marmoset, also a buddy of mine and someone to whom I'm so grateful. Like, that's what he likes to do. And you were like, no, I'm an artist and I'm going to build a studio in the backyard and I don't know what I'm going to make yet. Yeah. And I, to this day, I think you follow that. And that is something that is important here because people who are more naturally creative types who don't care as much about structure, it's easiest. And I don't quite consider myself that. I think I'm toward the middle of that bell curve. And I consider myself more of an artisan than an artist. Like, I like working with creative mediums, but I like putting together, like solving a thing, making a product. I don't mind that it's like making a client happy. That's fine with me. Yep. I like just figuring out how to put it together. And I'm less about like self-expression.
Yep.
But some people are even all the way on the other end of that, right? From you. And those people are always, I think, it's pretty safe to say, always going to want somebody to tell them what the system is. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that is a character defect. Mm. Your path is not going to be available to people who are on the other end because it will feel to them the way it would feel, you know, to me to do some of what you've done even. Mm-hmm. And it will feel even more like that to them, right? Of like, wow, that sounds risky.
If I'm honest, I think probably some part of I had so much authority trauma that I think being in authority in that context, you know, by the time I left, we were at the employees or something. I kind of stepped back in phases, but I was just like, I don't want this much power. You know, that was, I think, one aspect of it. And another aspect of it for sure was just, I have ADHD. The second we hit, I had kind of sort of semi-replaced myself. And I woke up one day and was like, I think I kind of like climbed some kind of crazy mountain. I was just, every bone in my body was like, I don't belong here anymore.
Yeah.
And I stepped into this really weird existential crisis, which you have witnessed firsthand for sure. And I think I was pretty disoriented by that for a long time. But yeah, I feel like rather than trying to assume the things that I'm bad at are flaws, I've increasingly allowed myself to embrace the fact that I'll probably always be kind of a little inclined to isolate myself and try to figure out how to do that as healthy as I possibly can.
Well, you know, I, for one, am glad that you have followed that tack because one of the things that you've produced is this song, Hootah. And you did that in part because you kind of followed those inclinations that you had. Maybe listened to that inner voice, if you want to call it that. And this song, as you've explained to me, since after I fell in love with it, the word Hootah is kind of one of those sort of tongues, like special personal words. And a lot of the lyrics of this song are basically about reclaiming some aspect of that childhood charismatic experience kind of on the other side of feeling shame for that. I don't want to put too many words in your mouth. I know you're going to be able to say more, but I just want to briefly set it up and then I want to play like a verse and a chorus so people can hear this song and have the context for it. Interestingly, the album is called Medicine, which I think is quite thematically connected here to this conversation. So let me play a little bit of Hootah. I'll just play it from the beginning through like a chorus or something like that. And if there are other parts, we can always play those.
May the power in my body release. I always wonder why I couldn't feel much. It's been ages and I missed your touch. Still nothing makes sense, but I can feel it in my marrow. Yeah, the power in my body runs deep. I saw Jesus on the front lawn. Use his feet to pop the cork off. He said he gets melancholy too sometimes, but I still get them goosebumps. Cause there's power in my body. May the power in my body release. fist just yet, but sometimes when I feel that shame, I lift my voice, I stake my claim. Ooh-tah, ooh-tah, little heartache, stealing snowflakes, my face gloves are. Ooh-tah, ooh-tah, get it fonder, little garden with the pruning sheep. Ooh-tah, ooh-tah, all the grandeur, all the mystery, all the sweet color. Ooh-tah, ooh-tah, and if ever you feel the sadness, sir, some corner.
I just want to soak in that for a minute. No, we can talk about it, but I just love that song so much.
That was very pastoral of you, Dan.
Just take a minute, see where this, what the spirit might be saying to you. I know the language. I could slip into that if I need to.
Yeah.
Well, what came up for you, like, given the context of our conversation now, and then me playing that first verse and chorus?
I think the thing that stands out to me, it's such a paradox to have something in your life that is so precious to you, that's tied up in something that's so toxic. Mm. So much about the child, like the picture of the person who doesn't have trauma. Mm. And for, like, I think a lot of what happened is that character was so idealized in my origin story, that even when you started to experience trauma and you weren't that little child anymore, you still aspired to be that little child. And even if you weren't, you know, and I feel like, yeah, I just experienced so much pain in church and so much joy. And there was a lot of, like, both of them. And this song is sort of me trying to enter into sort of angry gratitude, you know, sort of joyful, but kind of pissed off. Like, I think there's this idea that I had for a long time that I didn't get access. I don't know. I have had a good 20 years since I stopped going to church, but in a lot of ways, my spiritual practice was really tampered by this idea that I had this heritage, you know, and the heritage was that Christianity could be done and could be amazing, but it had to be done a very specific way, or it wasn't appropriate to do it.
I think that is by far Christians' experience of their own particular Christian tradition.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I like how Andrew Schwartz says there's no Christianity, there are Christianities.
Yeah.
Like, that's actually the most accurate way to talk about Christianity, is in the plural. Mm-hmm. And they disagree with each other. They all have Jesus at the middle of it in some way. They all claim, you know, Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth. But other than that, you know, there's, of course, some things that are more often agreed upon and more often disagreed upon, but they really are mutually incompatible. And yet, almost everyone's experience, unless you grow up like Unitarian Universalist or maybe some of these kind of modern, more progressive denominations, or classically liberal, kind of like mid-century liberal Protestant, unless you got that, then you almost always get a thick stripe of exclusivity. Mm. as part of the recipe, right?
Yeah. One of the things that's so hard for me, and this is where, you know, maybe the part of me that would be inclined toward atheism or something that comes out, is there's something so deeply, like, revealing about how rooted this, like, intellectual cockiness is in the culture, right? Mm. And that's really distressing to me. And I still don't know what to do with that. It makes me not want to be a Christian when I think about that particular thing. But this song is, it's funny because you see me spinning around and struggling because it's just what it's like for us.
Is that the creativity or the ADHD or what is
all of it? And the drama and the joy, all of it mixed together. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is really, I think, me, you know, I talk about my body in it. I actually think of the second verse. I mean, so there's a lot about body shame.
Hey, I'll play another verse. Let's hear it. Let's hear verse two. And, you know, while we're at it, we might get one more chorus because I can't say no to the chorus.
May the power in my body release. None of this makes sense, Lord. I got this feeling that the greens are all reds, Lord. I got this feeling I've been napping in bed. I got this feeling that the script's been flipped. Yeah. Everybody sees problems. Seven fingers in the red, we'd call them. The power of power in my body, may the power in my body release. Back then I didn't have a choice, couldn't see it all clear just yet, but sometimes when I feel that shame, I lift my voice, I stake my claim. Ooh-tah, ooh-tah, little heart.
before we get into the lyrics and all that, a few people are going to be thinking, like, where do I find this song? Again, the band is called Tents, as in there are many tents on display at REI. And it does feature members of Sherwood, my old band, and Motion City Soundtrack. Matt plays bass for you, at least when he's available and not doing MCS stuff. Mm-hmm. So Tents, that's the band, if you want to go listen to that. But let's talk about what's in that second verse.
I moved from Middle America, conservative Christian Middle America, to, you know, the belly of rebellion in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
Where I found a lot of kindred spirits and people all along the spectrum from, interestingly enough, I would, you know, the church I was part of was pretty alternative. I mentioned that. So a lot of alternative kids all came to the city and have ended up on all ends of the spectrum in terms of our views, but we're still generally very close. The song, along the way, I feel like we definitely developed this sort of religion of scorn, of looking over one's shoulder instead of looking forward, which it's really complicated there because I have done meaningful work. There's such a, for me, I think I've become cynical after 20 years about the practice of looking back.
You're saying that deconstruction itself can become a religion of scorn, where it has its own rhythms and rituals and emotional catharsis or whatever that for some people can replace the religious impulse, the religious practice or whatever. But rather than ideally something like redemption and forgiveness at the center, it's got, you know, I don't know, retribution or pain or unprocessed trauma or something like that. Obviously we're not here to victim blame, but in your experience, like you've seen friends kind of go down that path is what I take you to mean.
Yeah, well, I've been down that path and I think, and I am down that path, you know, and I think writing 10 songs is like spiritual practice for me. So I write these songs.
I know.
That's
why I wanted to talk to you about one.
Yeah. So it's an invitation for me, right? Into something deeper and more expansive. This, you know, when I spend time in prayer, I get this sense that there's just like overwhelming purpose and meaning and hope. And it's like, it's this sort of sensation that overrides any other sensation and resets how I see everything around me. And it's so profound. And when I experience it, I feel like I've been napping in bed and I feel like the greens are all reds. And that verse really captures that. Everybody's pointing fingers, you know, and then the red witch cuts them off and puts them in her cauldron.
Is the red witch, like, what's that indicative of?
Yeah, I mean, I gotta be careful. Shout out to my pagan brothers and sisters, you know, stealing from the caricaturizations of Disney. No, I don't know. Severed fingers in the red witch cauldron is like having a spell cast upon you of finger pointing. And that's really, I think for me, that's preaching to the choir, right? Like that's my own lived experience. But power hovers over wonder water, awestruck. That's a reference to Genesis 1. And there's power in my body. May the power in my body release, which is a sort of expulsion of this idea that my body is evil and embracing of the meaningful spiritual practice I have is in my body. And my body is good.
If you really enjoy and really value what you hear on this show, you can support it financially by becoming a patron at patreon.com/DanCoke. That link is in the show notes. It's $7 a month, and it includes access to at least 2 exclusive episodes per month that main feed listeners don't get to hear, as well as advertising free main feed episodes on your special patron feed, as well as membership in the Facebook group, which is an incredible online community of like-minded people asking very similar questions, helping each other with resources, you know, just kind of sharing stories, feeling less alone. I'm mixing it up in that group all the time, as is Josh Gilbert, and often Kristen and Sari, who work on marketing stuff. It's a cool community. It helps me make this show, helps me pay for my time, as well as the costs of paying for Josh, Kristen and Sari, and other, you know, associated costs with the show. So I'd really appreciate it. And we can make this world a better place together. Is that reaching too far? I don't know. Patreon.com/Dan Koch. Let's get back to the episode. You've got that Pentecostal charismatic base, and you've got that fundamental search of your dad's that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Each of which I think are pretty good, at least in some ways, as I understand them, as I understand Pentecostalism and charismatic Christianity, never having been a part of that community, taking the body more seriously than does an abstract, over-intellectualized, you know, let's say Dutch Reformed approach or something like that, Frozen Chosen, right? Where we sit still in the pews, also middle America. You do have some of that going on, plus just, I think, children understand, unless they have it kind of wrung out of them, they delight in their bodies and in using their bodies. We have an almost 4-year-old right now, and he loves doing stuff with his body, and he wears out. I run out of the energy in my body much, much more quickly than he runs out of his. So you've got that kind of good thing, but then that authoritative Christianity in America generally is anti-emotion or extremely suspicious of emotion, and many other sort of aspects of our body. Am I touching on some of that accurately there?
I mean, I definitely carry an enormous amount of body shame, to the point where when I hear someone from the queer community, or, you know, in particular, I feel like the queer community really speaks to me, or women who, or R&B singers, like there's certain men and certain subsets of the modern West that it's permissible for them to be really deeply in touch with their bodies on like on a sensitive level, not necessarily on an athletic level. And whenever I see someone like in their body and just really, really free, you know, and a lot of it, I think a lot of that for me, honestly, is like being a lead singer of a band. I write songs that really outpace me as a performer because I'm not, because I have all this body shame, you know? And so singing these kinds of songs and like really meaningfully performing them live is the most terrifying thing. And I almost feel like the more comfortable I get writing the songs, the more I'm like, I don't know how I would ever perform this in front of people in a really true, like authentic way. Like if I sing this song, I just start, and I'm really in it, I just start crying somewhere around verse two, you know? It's all so, yeah. So I think, I don't know, that kind of speaks to that, the body stuff. I don't know if I even answered your question.
Well, it's super interesting. There is a real thread of Gnosticism in a lot of Christianity. The idea that ultimately we are skeptical of our physical bodies. That's where all our sinful desires come from. You know, the four spiritual laws literally has a diagram in the back. Like after the four spiritual laws, like the fifth law basically is this diagram where it's like, you know, reason has to run the train and you got to put emotions in the caboose, right? So basically whatever you might feel in your body, that is untrustworthy unless it is lit up by the light of reason in line with God's truth, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's maybe never been a more convenient metaphor for like uncomfortable white men who are uncomfortable in their own bodies being in charge of a subculture. I mean, that's like, that is just the pure, you know, not from concentrate, fresh squeezed white male hegemony right there. But like, that is so thoroughly soaked into most American Protestantism. I think a little less so Catholicism, because there's so much ornamentation. There's so much room for artistry. Even Jesus's body is way more on display. You've got Jesus is on the cross for the crucifix. You've got the stations of the cross in most Catholic cathedrals, you know, on the walls to your left and right. A lot more focus on the body and blood of Christ. Literally, it's Christ's body that, you know, sort of sustains us week to week in those high church traditions. And that's got a different emphasis on the value and power. Is there power in the body? Whereas I think a lot of Protestantism is ultimately Gnostic. It's like, no, we have to put our bodies into submission to make sure that our souls can ascend to God. And that is our number one, if not maybe our only job while we're alive. And there are real consequences in that.
I don't know exactly where it all comes from. I think a lot about how much of it is just living in a world where you have to figure out how to motivate yourself to be contribute. It's such a big question. I'm sure you probably have many episodes I could listen to talking about this very question, but
I don't know if I do. I've got kind of one more line of inquiry with you. But before that, I something in what you're saying is bringing some stuff clear to me about my own continued identification as a Christian. This idea from earlier about distinguishing between the specifics of the schematic, the specifics of the map, and then the general principle of it. I think basically I need that separation. I need to be able to practice some form of Christianity without believing that it or any other specific version of it is like the true map, is the accurate map. Because as a kind of abstract thinker, you know, by nature, I can't help but run up against those questions. Like, I can't help but know that there are five atonement theories, you know, or whatever. Like, it's not available to me to sort of turn that analytic part of my brain off. And so I need a layer that goes, yeah, but that's not the point. That's not why we're here. You know, feel free to work on an essay or interview someone about that or what, you know, like it's okay that I'm interested in that way, in that stuff. I believe that I'm using whatever skill and interest I have in putting work in to then provide something that's helpful for other people around that stuff. But my own practice cannot be dependent upon it. It can't be about my theology. It has to be in, here and now in my body. It has to practically work, and I have to be able to set that aside, because otherwise I will be distracted. But also, I think that intellectually it's the most honest thing to do is to set it aside and say, so many of these questions are above our pay grade. How could we ever be confident we knew the answer to them? And if that's the case, why would we rest anything on them? They can't hold it. They can't hold the weight. You know, no offense to your dad, his specific schematic can't hold the weight of any individual person who might read what he published. Now, it can hold his weight, and some people will find that it can hold their weight. But as soon as you universalize it, you're screwed, because people are too varied. Even the personality dimension we were talking about earlier, between an artistic personality and like your drummer, Joe, one of my best friends, he is the opposite. He's not that way. That's just not the way he's wired. And so, yeah, so that's really becoming clear for me. And I really have to let go of the, like, what percent factual is this version of Christianity? Like, I have to leave that aside in order to practice it.
I love this thought experiment, and it's someone experiences the divine and without in a universe where there's no religion, no one's ever attempted to contextualize it, and they're maybe wired like you. And so they begin this joyful journey of discovery, like trying to figure out how to talk about it, how to hand it down to their kids, how to frame it up. It's so precious to them. The practice becomes, and so they give their lives to like basically creating liturgy, creating text, creating context, figuring out how to pass down, try to quantify this religious experience that they're having.
I love this thought experiment.
and for them, the spirit in which they are exploring is so earnest and so pure. Then their kids get it, right? And the football gets passed and passed. And at some point, there's a transition between joy and discovery toward dogma, right? And
this is not a thought experiment. This is just history.
Yeah.
I think it's very clear empirically that people are naturally religious. Mm-hmm. Now, you can parse that term in different ways, even in a way that's like becoming really interesting in the psychological literature in the West, as so many and most intellectuals are sort of post-religious. We are having to use this word spirituality to describe the propensity of our clients to want to find meaning and value in their life and figure out where that is and pursue that, right? It's like, it's something that's so ingrained in us. And if that's true, then that's been true for 200,000 years or more. That is how long we've been biologically and genetically human, Homo sapien. Mm-hmm. Call it another 2 million for most of those cognitive capacities, right? Sort of developing in different ways. Language comes a bit later because of certain things that develop in our tongue and stuff like that. But you've got to think, Brian, that essentially what you just described is the story of early man, early humans, humanity, of like, you know, and indigenous spiritualities would maybe be just for you, let me recommend, like, that might be an interesting area of study, because that is essentially, you know, that's the oral tradition of the initial members of your thought experiment.
Mm.
And there could be an interesting question as to, when does it become dogma? Does it only become dogma if society gets sort of economically a certain amount of development, becomes agrarian, et cetera? I don't know the answer to that. But like, that is, to me, honestly, like, one of the most interesting questions in the world is like, in what way would a human being be religious or spiritual without any of those trappings? Or, you know, like, what's that about?
Yeah. Oh, dude, that is such a good question. I keep thinking about I don't know. Dude, I don't even know how to answer that.
That's fine. Well, here's a question maybe you can't answer, and this is my last question. I mean, I want to just call out that, like, your thought experiment there went farther in time to where that becomes dogma, the joy becomes, you know, basically...
You become instead of a discoverer, you become a colonialist who's, maybe I shouldn't use that word, someone who's defending the way,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you switch.
It becomes an obligation, basically, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, then within that, of course, that's simplistic, because even in any authoritative congregation, there will almost always be a handful of nurturant individuals who have ways of softening the message and making it kind of work in a healthier way. And, you know, you could probably plot people's deconstruction on how much access to people like that did they have, you know, or not. Right. And you could find, I'm sure, some interesting correlations there. But where I want to go last is just, when you say today you're Christian, you're not going to church, as you said, you are engaged in this practice that sounds like, you know, basically contemplative prayer, sometimes walking, sometimes not. Some of your creative work, songwriting and other things like that, are a part of this. Obviously, I know it's connected to the way you're choosing to parent your children, you and Amy. So what about it is Christian? Like, why do you call it Christian and not just, I'm a spiritualist, or I'm spiritual but not religious, or whatever? So what makes it Christian in particular?
Well, before I get into that question, I should say I am Quaker interested right now.
Oh, nice. Love the Quakers.
The only thing, it's like the idea of home, you know. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a writer, and she said, the only thing I can do is to kind of make an about face and reckon with Christianity, because it's everywhere. It's my inheritance. It's my spiritual home. And I don't need any sort of magic slip. I don't need to check any certain boxes to have permission to reckon with it, to try to understand it, and even try to use it as a tool by which I can experience the divine. I would say the thing that I do that feels the most Christian to me is repent.
Say more about that.
The thing I learned in church was that God is this omnipotent, all-knowing, whatever creature, person, thing that has stuff figured out. In submission and subservience to God, we sort of are unlocked as people and get to live in our purpose, whatever it is, pick the Christianese language. And I guess my own experience reflects that. You know, you hear someone talking about feeling really big and really small when they do some hallucinogenic drug or whatever. Like, I really want my kids to have a tool by which they can access the ground of being. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like it would be so sad if I was old and I got this amazing thing and I got to keep it all to myself. And I had this crazy tool. It was like 50 tools in one and it fit in your pocket. And I just never showed it to my kids, you know. That's my impetus for, so I really identify with Meg, I guess, that idea that like, I have to be willing to possess this. Like, if I want to be a spiritually well person, I need to like wrestle with this. I need to understand it. And I need to be willing to do that with no earmarks, without any, I mean, there is a point at which it becomes intellectually irresponsible to say you identify a certain way when you believe nothing about it.
Yeah.
But at this point in my life, I'm giving myself freedom to do that because I come from such a destructive view that was the opposite. I need to get back in there and just work it out. So maybe I won't be in 5 years, but I just really care about the tool. And I care about the tool not being anything more than a tool.
One follow-up about kids. I mean, listeners know that I'm pretty bullish on the benefits of church, especially for kids and adolescents. There's a lot of research on adolescents. And there's even more benefit for adolescents from homes with lower means, mm-hmm. which makes sense, right? It's just kind of more access to more adults and possible sources of help and support. But how does church fit in when you and Amy talk about passing that down? It's obviously not the only way to pass it down to kids, but, you know, it's a standard way. I would imagine your feelings are conflicted and mixed on that, but I'm curious what they are.
Yeah, I've sort of resigned to the idea that I'm probably just not going to actually do the work to start a home church or wake up with my kids at 6 a.m. every morning and pray. Or maybe there's some version of me that would get to the point where I was more actively inviting my kids into my own practice. Mm-hmm. But I think that's much more likely to happen if I'm experiencing more resonance, you know, and more a stronger. There is something about, if you go to church or if you have a unifying experience with a group of people around a certain thing, it just motivates it in your heart and in your mind. And it makes it become more of a prominent thing that you think about. And so maybe part of it is I want to be emboldened, you know, to be more actively engaging in that way with my kids. And so I want church for myself so that will happen. One of the things I love about, oh my gosh, look, I went to a Quaker service and it's like, they don't think of any difference between the children and the senior pastors and almost any time.
Yeah.
And they sing these really simple songs. Like we both deal with anxiety. She deals with a lot of anxiety. And, you know, like we spent 20 minutes in silence we would sing a chorus and then contemplate our like quarter one of 2023. And then sing a chorus and then contemplate quarter two of 2023 and then sing a chorus. And it was like a chorus of gratitude and that, mm-hmm. you know, God sees me and loves me. And I was like, you know, I can react any way I want. But to me, that shit is like, that is like, that's working, you know? And I'm like, get family in there. Like, this is a vibe, you know? And so I'm at a point where I feel helpless and I feel so betrayed. I feel like my impulse not to trust people and not to be in community and not to engage with people is starting to really do a lot more harm than whatever good it did. So to that end, if I hear someone say something in a service every now and then that I disagree, you know, if I can find some kind of context that I feel like, yeah, this is healthy and positive, and there might be weird things attached to it, but I know my kids will really, really get to encounter what I've encountered and I'll be emboldened to share it with them. Like that's a high priority for me right now.
I love it. I've got two things and then I'm going to give you the last word on anything else you want to add. First, a quick ad for Quaker services. I've been to one Quaker Friends meeting here in Seattle, and one of the things that was interesting is all the pews were covered in quilts, and somebody explained at some point what the quilts were from. And, you know, there's Quakers and quilting. This is kind of like a, almost like a trope. But the congregation had made those quilts for like every, they made them like, I don't know, maybe quarterly or something like that, or monthly or every other month. And then at some point after they had been all in the service with the congregation, maybe they prayed over them or something, then those were donated to the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance or some similar organization. And the quilts were gifted to people going through radiation or chemo. And then they did it all again. And that was just so powerful. It was tangible. It was like both practical and a metaphor, you know? And I just thought that was so beautiful. And then the other thing I wanted to kind of end with is, like, you talk about repentance, and I've been thinking about this actually in very similar terms for a while now. Now, I am, unlike Quaker services, which are extremely unstructured by design, both Jaffrey and I have found that we like the kind of highly structured liturgical thing. I don't meet criteria for ADHD. She may or may not. We go back and forth on that. It's not a huge issue, but we like kind of being brought along by the structure, having something to focus on. I also like the sort of wisdom tradition over hundreds of years, kind of refining this language and seeing what works best. And one of the things that I think the church has found works best, the church on the whole, is this process of confession and repentance and then receiving of grace. Mm-hmm. And for me now, it's like, I don't think of that in theological terms anymore of, well, how specifically are our sins covered and forgiven? Like theologically, I would just say, well, if God can create a universe, then God can forgive sins however God wants to. But psychologically, experientially, the catharsis of taking a moral inventory on a regular basis, being fucking honest about it, and then laying that sort of out in front of you, and then as a group saying, God has forgiven you. And, you know, people who are able to go to confession, who are Catholic or whatever, I think you might even get more catharsis from that. Of course, this can become disordered. You know, you think about religious flavors of OCD and religious scrupulosity and all that stuff. And of course there's a dark side there. And I have worked with multiple clients, you know, along those lines. But just for your average person, if there's not a time to feel not only forgiven yourself, but to feel like the world includes the possibility of forgiveness, what's the world look like without that? You know, I think it just piles up. You just have to be better, do better, and then do better, and then do better, and then do better until what? And when do you know that it's enough? And there is, you know, I think what I'd like to say, I'd maybe want to think about it more, but like no amount of anything literally is ever enough. No amount of good deeds, no amount of bad deeds, even if you are convicted and you serve 10 years and you've paid your debt to society. There are all kinds of ways that you could feel like you were there too long, or someone else thinks you were there not long enough. Like, no one agrees upon that. And so maybe this somewhat artificial, perhaps, kind of, well, God forgives you. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think it's artificial because of that experiential angle that you and I both share. But even if someone did think it was artificial, that still has a value. Mm-hmm. That has like a practical value to allow someone to go, okay, you want me to do better? Here's how I do better. I confess, I receive forgiveness, I try again. I refocus my life around the things that are important to me. Mm-hmm. And the church that we have been at off and on for 13 years now has that in the liturgy. You know, all the more liturgical churches have a confession and some sort of a receiving of grace. And man, my estimation of the value of that regular practice just continues to go up and up and up. And that's also something that I want for my boys, you know, like, yeah, we do make mistakes and we can ask forgiveness and we can receive forgiveness and we can grow. And again, without giving anything away, if you have Hulu, watch Fargo season 5. You do not have to see any of the previous 4 seasons. Watch it. And when you watch the final 10 minutes of the finale, think about what I said here and then send me an email or an Instagram message or something and let's talk about it. That's all I have. Brian, do you have anything to end with or you want to respond to that?
You know, I just want to say thanks for the show, Dan. Like it's been become a really positive to hear resonant voices and your inquisitiveness and just like unguarded curiosity has been really, really, really good for me. And I've been enjoying this podcast for, I feel like it keeps kind of ticking up. Like I've been more and more actively catching most of the episodes and so I just really appreciate it. I mean, I know you probably, it's maybe automatic for you or whatever, just part of your thing, but it's really helpful.
I appreciate that.
Means a lot. So.
Well, this conversation meant a lot to me. This is clarifying, and I know it will be for many listeners. So again, the band is Tenths. Do you have I know you got your Instagram handle, and where else could people find you if they want to kind of connect?
Yeah. Instagram would be my first recommendation. My second would be YouTube, and my third would be Spotify. I've posted a lot of content on all those places, and a lot of my content is sort of, a lot of our songs are around family, kind of existential, what it means to exist, and then being kind of post-evangelical and trying to find joy and purpose and positivity in that space. And I genuinely think of it as like me just cooking up gifts for people. Like it's out there for you. If it's encouraging to you, it would be great to connect.
Also, one last little plug, the video for Huta, you got some write-ups on some video blogs and stuff because you did one of the first like 360 camera music videos where you filmed it forward and backward basically, right? So verse and chorus switches between forward and backward, but we're getting a different angle from the 360 camera and you learn to sing it backwards and stuff. So if you just want to hear the whole song for the first time, I would recommend watch the YouTube video rather than just listening to the audio because it's such a cool visual. But if you're like me, it's going to make it onto your most exclusive playlists as a top track. Brian Hall, man, thank you so much. We'll have the links to all of those in the show notes, by the way, Josh. Josh will put them in there. Thanks, Josh Gilbert, as usual, for editing and producing. And man, what a great time. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Dan.